All right, we are continuing our study of the Gospel of Matthew here on the Listener's Commentary, and in this recording, we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 17, verses 14 through 27. And this section picks up really where the last one left off. In fact, it's very much a continuation of the previous episode. And that previous episode was where Matthew recounted Jesus' transfiguration, that event where Jesus and three of his disciples were up on the mountain, and Jesus' physical appearance was changed. He gleamed white, and his glory was displayed. He met with Moses and Elijah. Well, that's the preceding story. Here in this one, we pick up with that story being over. They are now on the way down from the mountain where that event happened. And at the base of that mountain are nine of the 12, the three that went with Jesus, Peter, James, and John. The other nine waited down at the base of the mountain, and that's where they are. And so a crowd now has gathered around them. And so in a very real sense, we return from that glorious moment on the mountain to a real life struggle down in the valley. On the mountain, three of the 12 got a powerful glimpse of Jesus' royal splendor, but the nine, they're waiting down below, and once again, they're struggling to grasp Jesus' authority, his power, and his authority that he has shared with them. That's where we pick up here then in Matthew 17, verse 14, that reads like this. When they came to the crowd, so we've come down from the mountain. The they here is Jesus, Peter, James, and John. So when they came to the crowd, a man came up to Jesus, falling on his knees before him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son. In other words, he's begging Jesus for help. He's asking for pity. He's asking for compassion. Lord, have mercy on my son. And then he explains why, what his son needs. Have mercy on my son because he has seizures and suffers terribly, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. In fact, the verb that's translated, he has seizures, is a rare verb that literally means moonstruck. We learn from verse 18 down below that the source of this malady was an evil spirit. But before we get to that, we learn that this man had already asked Jesus' disciples, the nine who had been waiting at the base of the mountain, he'd asked them for help, and they weren't able to provide it. Look at verse 16. He says, and I brought him, that is his son, to your disciples, and they couldn't cure him. Now, in order to feel the full weight of this, we have to recall what Matthew's already told us at the beginning of chapter 10. There, at the beginning of chapter 10, Jesus gave his disciples authority over unclean spirits. He gave them the power and the authority to cast them out. He gave them authority to heal every kind of disease and sickness. And since Matthew has already told us that, it's surprising then to find that they can't solve the problem here. So what's the issue? Why are they struggling to do this? Well, here's how Jesus responds, verse 17. And Jesus answered and said, you unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me. Now, this is a strong rebuke. And in this context, in view of the fact that the man had just said Jesus' disciples couldn't cure him, it seems like this rebuke is actually directed at Jesus' disciples, at the nine who hadn't been able to help. Jesus had given them authority to do this kind of stuff. And therefore, they ought to have been able to handle it while Jesus was away up on the mountain with Peter, James, and John. But they had failed. And the reality is before long, Jesus knows they're going to have to be able to handle it because he's not going to be around much longer. And yet they're still suffering, it seems, from Jesus' rebuke here. They're still suffering from the same malady as the generation around them. They're struggling to see it. They're not believing fully in who Jesus is. They don't trust the authority that he has and the authority that he's given them. And so it seems that this strong rebuke is really a challenge to his disciples. Yes, it may include the broader crowd and some of the issues there, but I think the focus here is on the nine disciples who couldn't solve the problem while Jesus was away. And so, verse 18 says, and Jesus rebuked him, Now, at this point, he's rebuking the boy that has the demon. So, and Jesus rebuked him, that is, the demon inside the boy, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was healed at once. And so, the heart of this issue wasn't just that he was having seizures. Jesus knew what lay behind it was the presence of an evil spirit, and so he rebuked that spirit. The spirit came out of the boy was healed at once, and then later, the disciples come to Jesus privately and said, "Why could we not cast it out?" And it's a fair question. They should have been able to. Jesus had given them authority. And so they're wondering, wait, what went wrong? Why were we not able to cast it out? And look at the answer Jesus gives in verse 20. He said to them, "Because of your meager faith." And that word meager is little. It's the same word that Jesus already used to refer to them as little faiths. Here's the problem. They're part of that faithless generation, you unbelieving and perverse generation. And so maybe they don't totally fit the perverse part of the generation, but the faithless part, the little faith part, they've got that down. And that's the problem, because of your meager faith. And then Jesus goes on to say, and it's not like your faith has to be huge. It doesn't have to be huge to be effective. Look what he says. Because of your meager faith, for truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed. Now, recall that in chapter 13, in the parable about the mustard seed, Jesus referred to the mustard seed as the smallest seed in the garden. It's the smallest seed, he says. So to say that their faith only needs to be the size of a mustard seed communicates two things. First, it communicates how tiny their faith must actually be. I mean, if this mustard seed is the smallest of the seeds, then their faith is so small that it's barely even there. That's what he means when he says your faith is meager or little. It's tiny. And the second thing this communicates is you don't have to have great faith, right? They don't have to have huge, massive, great faith. Just small faith will do. We just got to get up to small faith, the size of a mustard seed. And so he says, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. Now, remember that Jesus and the three other disciples have just hiked down off a mountain. So you need to picture Jesus pointing to the mountain they've just come down and saying this. He's saying, look at this mountain. If you have just tiny little faith like a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. R.T. France says the sovereign authority of Jesus the Messiah in healing and exorcism is unique, and his disciples can draw on it only if they have faith. And in this case, that's what they failed to do, he says, and that's the problem. And so what we see is that although Peter had very recently just confessed his faith in Jesus as the Messiah and God's Son, and presumably the 11 had been standing there nodding along with him, they're all still struggling to fully get it, to live out their faith and the vocation that Jesus is calling them into. And so Jesus is going to spend more and more time focused on them over the next handful of weeks as he prepares them for what's about to happen. Now, before we look at the second half of this episode, just then a little reflection on what we've seen here. And what this story reminds us is it's true not only for them, but for us. We don't have to have huge faith. We don't have to have massive faith. Just a little faith will do. If we just have faith the size of a mustard seed, then God will work powerfully through our lives and our prayers. And so we need to grow in faith. And maybe our faith is meager and little and barely existent like the disciples. Well, let's grow in faith. And the second part of that reflection is this, that really at the heart of discipleship to Jesus is just this thing, growing in faith, specifically growing in faith by listening to Jesus. Recall at the Transfiguration in our last recording that God spoke from the cloud to the three disciples and said, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. Hear him. Hear, listen, understand, and put into practice the things you hear from him." And as you do that, the reality is, your faith will grow. And so that's the essence, the heart of discipleship is growing in faith by listening to Jesus. And all of us need that. And so may our faith grow from meager and barely there to the size of a mustard seed so that God can work powerfully in and through our lives for his purposes and for his glory. Now, chapter 17 continues on after that and picks up in verse 22 with a follow-up snapshot. It says this, "And while they were gathering together in Galilee." So the last specific place that Matthew mentioned was Caesarea Philippi, up north. And this line, therefore, has the idea of reconvening and gathering together in Galilee proper. So they've come back down south. They're maybe back in Capernaum. They're at least going to be back near the Sea of Galilee. And Matthew actually seems to use a very unique and specific word for gathering together. One scholar actually looked at a number of places where that particular word was used and found that it was typically used of groups gathering in preparation for pilgrimage to Jerusalem for feasts. And that's actually quite appropriate here, because right after this little episode, Matthew's going to include his fourth major teaching block in the gospel, this one directed at the 12 apostles. And then immediately after that, they're going to begin their journey to Jerusalem for the final Passover. And so we should probably hear this gathering together in Galilee as them preparing to head to Jerusalem. And in that context, Jesus says this. Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is going to be handed over to men, and they will kill him, and he will be raised on the third day." And they, that is the disciples, were deeply grieved. Now, this is the second major prediction of what's going to happen to Jesus when they get to Jerusalem. And what he is effectively doing is preparing them for, we're going to Jerusalem for the Passover, and it's not going to play out well. And you need to know that, and you need to be mentally and emotionally prepared for that. And so he's warning them and preparing them of that. And they get it, kind of. They're deeply grieved about this, even if they don't understand the full significance or import of what Jesus is getting at. And then Matthew recounts a short little brief interchange before the large teaching block, before the trip south to Jerusalem, a small little interchange between Peter and Jesus himself about one particular little question. Look what happens in verse 24. "Now, when they came to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter and said, 'Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?'" The 2 drachma tax refers to the temple tax. It's not a tax collected by the Romans. It was one collected by the Jews. And you would have representatives of the priesthood, particularly the priesthood in Jerusalem, then were sent out to collect it. And so it is the temple tax, and it was actually collected the month prior to Passover. That fits very well with the timing where we're at. So we're about a month out from Jesus' final Passover, somewhere in those final few weeks leading up to that. These representatives have come and asked Peter if Jesus is going to pay that tax. And all adult Jewish men were, in some regards, expected to pay it annually. But there was growing debate among various Jewish groups about this. The Sadducees themselves disapproved of it as a recent Pharisaic kind of invention. Members of the Qumran community, on principle, only paid it once in their lifetime, and that was it. So the question they ask here, the way it's worded, actually expects a positive answer. "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax?" And they're expecting Peter to say yes. It expects a positive answer. It's just wanting to make sure that Jesus is good with paying that tax, unlike some of those other groups who are beginning to question the validity of the tax. So Peter answers, verse 25. He said yes. And then Peter comes into the house and talks to Jesus about it. And so when he came into the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax, from their sons or from strangers?" So maybe Jesus overheard the conversation with Peter outside, who knows, but he knows what's going on. And so he uses this as sort of a teachable moment. And he asks Simon, that is Peter, a little question. And the point of the question is, does a royal family tax itself, right? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll tax? From their sons or from strangers? The royal family doesn't tax itself, right? That's the point. Peter said, from strangers, obviously. No royal family is going to tax itself. Jesus said to him, so the sons are exempt. Now, it's a little unclear what Jesus is getting at when you read the rest of what he says. But what it seems like he's saying is that since he's the Messiah and the Son of God, that's a royal title, he's like a king, right? And Peter has recently confessed that. So Peter and his disciples are sort of like his family. So they're like sons of the kingdom. And so what Jesus seems to be getting at is that technically, on principle, they should be exempt from paying this tax. Nevertheless, look what Jesus says in verse 27. However, so that we do not offend them, go to the sea and throw in a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a stater. Take that and give it to them for you and for me. Now, notice what Jesus just said. He seems to have just said that the sons of the kingdom are exempt. So technically, he and Peter shouldn't have to pay this tax. However, so that we do not offend them. And that word offend literally means like cause to stumble, cause to be ensnared. It's not just bug them, bother them. It's more like the idea that we trip them up to their own demise. In fact, that word offend is going to be translated stumbling block in the teaching block that follows right on the heels of this in chapter 18. We don't want to be a stumbling block. We don't want to cause them to be ensnared and trapped to their own demise. So because of that, he says to Peter, go to the sea, throw in a hook, catch a fish. When you catch that fish, open its mouth and you will find a stater. A stater was a coin worth 4 drachmas. Remember, this is the 2-drachma tax. So 4 drachmas is enough for Peter and for Jesus. And so you're going to find a 4-drachma coin in this fish's mouth. Somehow, some way, miraculously, that's going to happen. Take that and give it to them. Give it to those representatives you were just talking about and pay the tax for you and for me. One scholar refers to this as like a theological object lesson. The idea is that in this little interchange between Peter and Jesus, well, it shows us how Jesus is helping Peter see that sometimes you got to give up your freedoms for the sake of others. Technically, the sons of the kingdom, Peter's one of those, and Jesus is the king, technically, they should be free from having to pay this tax. But even if that was the case, for the sake of not causing other people to stumble over the kingdom, they should pay for it for the sake of other people. And that's really an important lesson for us as well. There are times, in this case, even dealing with paying a tax, there are times where it's best for the sake of the kingdom, for the sake of not causing somebody to stumble and be ensnared, right? To stumble over the kingdom. There's times where it's best for us to forego our own freedom in order to preserve our witness to the kingdom. There's times where it's better for us to say, you know what, I am free and I don't have to do that, but it's better for the reputation of the kingdom of God and the reputation of Jesus to just give up my freedom. That's the object lesson that Jesus just taught Peter with the specific instance with the 2-drachma tax. All right, thanks for tuning into this session on the Listener's Commentary on the New Testament. The Listener's Commentary is a listener-supported, crowd-funded Bible teaching ministry that is made possible by the generous support of people just like you. So to each and every one of you who make this ministry possible, thanks a ton for your support. And if you've been blessed or impacted in some way by this ministry, could I just ask you, invite you to prayerfully consider joining the team of supporters so that this ministry can continue to grow and continue to impact people all around the world. Thanks in advance for your support.